This week in your parents' basement, we're hiding in cardboard boxes to take out the rogue agents at the Shadow Moses facility. We're hitting another milestone with tonight's episode number 32 and playing our first 32-bit game, Konami's Metal Gear Solid from 1999. I'm Steve Greenwell. With me is regular co-host. He's a guy who knows how to take down a nuclear-powered robot. It's Todd Brisket.
I don't need a handkerchief. I don't have any more tears to shed.
Our other co-host, Huel, he's unavailable today because he's hunting down Psycho Mantis in the Alaskan plains. So today, we have a special returning guest. He's a mysterious cyborg ninja himself with mutated DNA. It's my old buddy from GameFAQs, it's Dale.
Steve, make sure you have a hard backup copy of this podcast by pressing the record button.
Definitely. You can reach us by email at parentsbasementpodcast@gmail.com and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. If you like the show, be sure to subscribe to it on iTunes and give us some stars. Also, get into the giving holiday spirit and properly celebrate National Cotton Candy Celebration Day. Support our show by using the Amazon click-through link on www.ypbpodcast.com. Today's game is Metal Gear Solid from 1999. Back in 1987 and 1988, a neat little series debuted for the NES and MSX home computer. Metal Gear was one of the first games to dip its toe into the stealth action genre, as it required you to solve some puzzles and sneak past enemies instead of just gunning them down, like in these standard action games of the time, like your Contras, your Super C's, those kind of things. Although there were two sequels released in 1990, called Snake's Revenge and Metal Gear 2, the series was more of a cult classic for a long time. In fact, it skipped the 16-bit generation of systems entirely, and it had been dormant for 9 years when Metal Gear Solid came out for the PlayStation. However, Metal Gear Solid, it was incredibly well-received and made an immediate impact. It ultimately sold more than 6 million copies on the PlayStation, and it was re-released and sold again and again and again. It's probably the most significant entry from a historical perspective when it comes to the action stealth games on the console. It originally started development as a 3DO game in 1994, but it was shifted to the PlayStation as the 3DO kind of went the way of the dodo. Dale, you recently finished a thorough playing of this game for a charity drive, so why don't you start the discussion off for us this week?
Alrighty. Yeah,
Don't sound too excited.
Oh, man. Well, it's been crazy. I just finished the game earlier today, like about 4 or 5 hours ago. But I started it on the charity drive. I don't know if you guys follow that Extra Life kind of yearly. They kind of have an unofficial start date for it around October each year. So around Halloween, like people stay up for 24 hours, play games and whatnot. I don't know if you guys follow that stuff.
Mm-hmm. A couple of my friends do that, too.
Yeah, I met with a couple buddies out of town, and we mostly just sat on our own station playing our own games, and I just did a theme where I was like, I'm going to play GameCube games. So I finished the day off with the Metal Gear Solid, the Twin Snakes there on GameCube, the remake of the PS1 game. So I didn't actually play the original PS1 release, but yeah, this is a GameCube remake that came out 5 years later by Silicon Knights. But, and then I just kind of picked and played at it away, hour here, hour there, and I just finished it like 4 or 5 hours ago earlier today. So I got it pretty fresh in my mind here. But,
How'd you care for it? How many troops did you sneak up on and choke out?
Well, I'm not like a... probably a true hardcore stealth gamer. So, like, when I played the only other Metal Gear Solid game I played to completion was the fourth one. And like how I did it in that one, I just kind of put it on very easy. And I didn't go all run and gun, but I didn't go all super sneaky either. It was kind of a little bit of a mix of both. I tried to be sneaky when I can, and but I didn't really die too much, thank goodness for the difficulty adjustment, minus falling through some random, like, disappearing trap doors or whatever. But, I dug it. all these years later, it still holds up. It's where there's some things that are a little odd about it that are kind of don't maybe stand the test of time. Some things with the controls. I don't know. How do you guys like that, like, vintage Metal Gear Solid control scheme where you got to cycle through the menus with the trigger buttons? Do you think that still kind of plays well with you today?
No. Well, I kind of, I guess. It's similar to Fallout 4, which I know a couple of us have been putting many hours into lately, where you cycle through it. But no, I can't handle that in today's gaming world, because I'm pretty much a pure PC gamer, so I'm used to just clicking around with the mouse and easily scrolling through everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like I'm willing to give Metal Gear Solid more of a pass because it was one of the first good games of this sort. But yeah, I found the interface to be a little bit clunky here and there.
Right.
And like my first time playing through this game, like back in my teen years, like I didn't get a single dog tag in like my first or second playthrough. Like I didn't even know that was like a gameplay aspect that you could, you know, get those and get power ups through them, that kind of thing.
Really?
I only got three of the dog tags. That was just from like a few of the bosses there, and I read up on how you had to get the other ones, and I guess I didn't even bother on trying to. You get, it's like you got to like sneak up and do like and like strangle the soldiers a certain way. It's not even all soldiers; it's random enemies, right?
Yeah, pretty much. It's kind of meant as an Easter egg sort of thing, and this whole series is full of like tons of weird Easter eggs, and that'd be one of them. To the point where I don't know, there are certain times they break the fourth wall in this game intentionally and unintentionally.
Oh, I love it.
yeah, with some of the codec things that they say. Oh, you can turn to certain channels on the codec, and there'll just be, you know, the commander is going to yell at you for doing that kind of stuff.
I tried to just monkey around with random codec stations, seeing if I could find some secret stuff. I guess I didn't stumble into any, but I did love the codec transmissions. I found it in a weird way, kind of reminded me of Mass Effect of all games, because I noticed that after every time a little bit of gameplay went by, if you called into everyone, almost everyone would have different conversations with you depending on what you're doing with the game. So I'm like, oh, I got to see what Otacon and Master and Campbell are all thinking of my progress so far. I'm like, why am I doing this?
Yeah. No, I did the same thing. I don't know why that was so compelling, but it definitely was.
It would bug me nowadays, because aren't you stuck on that screen watching them talk to you? I think they've fixed this in Metal Gear Solid 5, where you can turn on your codec and then still walk around and do stuff.
Oh, okay. Well, that would definitely help.
Yeah, that would finally make it kind of like an actual realistic immersive situation, whereas, you know, like we were saying about Fallout, you can just, you know, play messages for 5 minutes while you're in the middle of a firefight.
Yeah.
like, oh, let me just go to the menu to heal. I played this game a tiny bit this week, but I had beat it in the past. But there was one aspect I could not get past at any point in my gaming career. And now we're going to get into spoilers for the story here. I guess we should discuss the story first a little bit.
Yeah, I have a little snippet to read about the story.
Oh, go right ahead.
Ripped straight from the manual.
Oh, nice.
It goes like this. Here's the intro story to the game for anybody that has never heard of this game, that's never played it. It's about metal gears that are solid. Here's the story, how the story goes. The nuclear weapons disposal facility on Shadow Moses Island in Alaska's Fox Archipelago was attacked and taken over by Next Generation Special Forces, being led by members of Foxhound. They're currently demanding that the government of the United States turn over the remains of Big Boss, and they say if their demand is not met within 24 hours, they'll launch a nuclear weapon. Solid Snake, in parentheses, you, has two mission objectives. The first is to rescue the DARPA's chief, Donald Anderson, and the president of Arms Tech, Kenneth Baker. Both are being held as hostages. Secondly, Snake has to investigate whether or not the terrorists have the ability to make a nuclear strike and stop them if they do. So that kind of sums it up.
Yep. And well, my issue with the part I found the hardest was, as you're going through, you stumble across Merrill, because this series plotline is so convoluted. Brisket, do you have what relation she is? Is she like the president's daughter or something like that? Or
I think she is the niece. Commander's niece.
Okay. At one point, she is getting tortured and threatened to be killed. And to save her, you basically have to jam on like the X button. I could not actually ever save her. And I tried many, many times, and she pretty much
died.
You
need to get a turbo button?
I should have, but no, I didn't care about Meryl that much.
Is she optional to save? It's been so long since I've played this game, I can't remember.
Yes, in this game, you get different endings depending on whether you save her or not, I believe. But you can beat the game either way. Canonically, I believe, she lives. Because she shows up again in Metal Gear Solid 4. Correct, Dale? That's the
yep.
one you played, right?
Oh, yeah, she's in 4.
Okay. So
that's weird. I don't remember playing a scene, seeing her getting tortured. Off the top of my head, anyways. I remember the part where Snake's getting tortured.
I think it's something like you have to jam on the buttons to free Snake or something mm-hmm. like that. And otherwise, they're going to kill her.
Oh, okay. I gotcha. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. I think I know what you're talking about. Yep. Yep. Because Ocelot's running his little torture trap or whatever, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I also remember being kind of intense because I was like 15 at the time. But,
mm-hmm.
but you know, you got to grow up sometime.
You know, I could see how this game would be. One thought that kept coming through my mind was, you know, the game has really awesome. Again, it's going from the GameCube version, but I did watch a few clips of the PS1 original here over the last day just to get a good idea. And even from when I saw it too, I thought both versions had great. You know, I can imagine back when it first came out in the '99 that the cinematic. Cutscenes and camera angles must have blown everyone away.
Yeah, that's one thought I had is that this is probably one of the first games where it actually, you know, cinematography came into play. Mm-hmm. This one and, you know, some of the earlier PlayStation games but this is one where it really shines and there's a lot of talky cutscenes with camera angles and zooming the camera around.
I mean, it just kind of goes to show, yeah, like, I always hear people like kind of like a generation older than me kind of go like they always refer to like the original Ease Books 1 and 2 for being a game that's kind of among their favorites because like at the time it had these like voiced over fully animated intros for the game and had really good top-notch presentation aspects for it that were unparalleled for like 1990 or 91 and I think no, this is probably like around our generation's that equivalent. And while I didn't experience Metal Gear Solid for that time, another game that came out around that same time, Shenmue, that kind of set the bar for me. And I,
oh yeah,
the presentation for that game, they had the same quality or very similar style of camera, high budget, and kind of made you kind of look over some of the weaker core gameplay mechanics. But it just made me just absolutely love the game, and I could see how this game could. And while the story is so heavy with the, like you said, Steve, very convoluted with all the political sci-fi and all that, I tried my best to follow it, and they kind of do a good job of gradually doling out information for all the various factions and stuff within the game you got to deal with.
Yeah. So yeah, I just read that introduction. It has all this stuff like Foxhound and Next Generation Special Forces and all this stuff. And I played the game and I still have no idea what's going on. Who's who? Who's the bad guy? Who's the good guy? Yeah. I don't get it.
Well, I mean, the Metal Gear Solid games, they are lush to look at. Like, even this, I mean, it shows its age as a PlayStation game. The GameCube remake, the graphics are actually, they still hold up pretty well. The PlayStation 1, you know, it's definitely blocky. But it's still, you know, it's not blocky like a Saturn game. It's still definitely, like, playable. But the story, you can follow the story in this one, in the PlayStation game. Like, it's kind of, you just kind of have to realize, oh, these are double agents. There are many double crosses going on here, that kind of stuff. But, you know, it's workable.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's like, even though there's a lot to take in just by reading a general plot synopsis, like the way the game plays out, it's not like they throw it all at you at once.
No, they work you into it, and I think they want you to be a little confused at first because you're playing a character who doesn't have perfect knowledge.
He's brought out of retirement. He was retired in this game.
He's too old for this. So I think from that perspective it works pretty well. Now from there, the rest of the series it just gets weirder and weirder, and so I'm gonna spoil some of the games right now. Metal Gear Solid 2 actually this is probably the one that the last one that has kind of an accessible story, even though it spirals out of control like the last hour. At first, in Metal Gear Solid 2, you play as Snake for about 15 minutes as you infiltrate this sub or tanker thing. And then, for the rest of the game, you play as Raiden. And it's one of the most famous double-cross switches on the audience, like, ever. Because you don't get to play as Snake again for the rest of the game. And he's kind of the star of the series. But basically, Metal Gear Solid 2, you find out at the end that the whole exercise was an attempt to see if they could recreate another Solid Snake kind of soldier. And you are basically following the events of the first game, and it's meant to be like a mock exercise to create pressure on Raiden to see if he'll do the same that Snake did. But there's complicating factors. Even on that experiment, there are rogue agents. And then at the end of the game, you find out, oh, the people controlling this have been dead for 150 years. And they're AI cores or something. And
okay.
And then from there, it gets more confusing. The game, the Metal Gear Solid 2 chronology is picked up in 4, where 4 is set, you play as Old Snake.
Yes.
And he is, you know, he's graying. He thinks he's going to die because the super soldier serum that he was injected with years ago, apparently the side effect, it makes you die out young, all this kind of stuff. And they try to walk back some of the weirder elements of the series, like the fact that you're part of an organization that's been doing stuff that's been dead for 200 years. And it's incomprehensible. And 3 and 5 are both prequels. So
yes,
3, I believe, is set in like the 50s or 60s, I want to say.
Yeah,
maybe 70s.
I was actually just looking at
64 is
64.
What it says.
Okay,
Snake Eater, right?
Yeah, yeah. And three, I believe you play as I want to say Big Boss or
yep.
You play as Solid Snake's kind of predecessor in a way.
Big Boss. That's one thing I never got about this series, and why it's so confusing to me. I mean, I'm able to handle some complicated stories, fellas. Don't get me wrong. You know, I have the in the entire Song of Ice and Fire wiki memorized. I'm able to handle some stories. But every time I see this game, and it's either a Snake or it's a Big Boss or it's a Venom Snake or it's a Solid or it's a Liquid Man or whatever it is, I just don't know what's going on. One, some of them have eye patches. Some of them have eye patch on the other eye. Some, you know, they all have a. They're all copying Snake Plissken.
I definitely think it's the deception element of the storyline that makes it so hard to follow. In that, basically, everyone is lying throughout all of these games about who they are working for and their loyalties. So it's kind of like these huge, overreaching spy plots. Whereas, I don't know, it's not like Final Fantasy VII has a totally legit storyline or anything like that. But even like those weird Japanese RPGs, I find easier to follow than the tangled web that your solid weaves here.
Yeah.
And five takes place in the 80s, I believe, and it's very well reviewed. To kind of touch on the history aspect, the series has sold more than 41 million units. Metal Gear Solid 2, which was a PlayStation 2 game, is the top seller at 7 million. The latest installment is Metal Gear Solid 5, The Phantom Pain, which was released in September to basically every review I saw for it was between like 92 and 97%. So it's set 11 years before the first NES game and 21 years before Metal Gear Solid. It's the usual stealth action and stylized cutscenes, but it also has a base building and recruiting function that's not seen in past games. I believe you're building up the Diamond Dogs is what they're called. So
yeah, I hear nothing but great buzz, and the game's probably going to be getting a lot of good Game of the Year award talk here probably for the end of the year coming up pretty soon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which, you know, seems to be justified. I mean, I've mentioned now many times about how hard it was to keep up with the story, but these are all fun games to play, and they're kind of, you can definitely feel like the Hollywood influence on them. The fact,
oh yeah, they're very cinematic.
Mm-hmm. Brisket, do you have the name of the genius behind the series? Since you normally
Hideo Kojima, Kojima-san.
Since you normally like to read our ethnic names. He is gone from Konami, and 5 is going to be his last game, and Konami is somewhat mum on whether they're going to continue the series or not.
Yeah. Well, there's some talk that Konami is completely getting out of the console gaming altogether and just going to like casual portable games.
Yeah, they've been sending some mixed messages. I remember like before when they first announced that Hideo was leaving Konami, they're like, "Oh no, we'll still." At first, they're sending out messages saying they'll still be making Metal Gear Solid games for down the line. And but then later on, you know, like you just said, Brisket, they now they said they're going to not focus on traditional console games, with the exception of their yearly soccer game, and now it's just they're going to be doing their pachinko games and cell phone games. I mean, have you seen the trailers for some of their pachinko games? It's crazy.
Like
they got a Castlevania pachinko game.
Oh really?
Oh yeah.
Oh gosh, yeah. Yeah, YouTube it. It looks pretty wild.
And it is kind of weird to think that Konami would just get out of like the what is it, the 4A development games that they're called, like the big budget AAA games, because they have some like all-star franchises.
Mm-hmm.
They're all going to be like mobile phone game versions of them now.
Oh man.
Well, yeah, and I don't know. I can understand if they don't want to make another big budget Castlevania game, because those are kind of iffy, but you know, Metal Gear seems to do pretty well each year in terms of sales.
Well, yeah, I mean, considering that 5 seems to be such a smash hit and well reviewed, there, I don't see why they would not just do more of the same, at least.
Yeah,
they have very a formula least right there.
Find a way to like broker a deal so if someone else wants to take the reins, but find a way for Konami to still get a little cut of it to allow people to still enjoy future games to come, and then, you know, if they got to sign off on the story and all that to make it all official and canon and Konami approve it, I get it. But yeah,
exactly, Dale. I was just gonna say, like, I'm sure there's, I mean, I can understand if you're another company, if you're Electronic Arts, maybe you don't want to spend $100 million to basically license a game from Konami. Like, you probably don't want to spend the money on a Castlevania game. But if you're a 3DS developer, like, the cost for those kind of games are much lower. And to me, it seems like the 3DS should be kind of a... and the Vita should be decent systems for things like, oh, let's make a 2D Castlevania game. Let's make another Gradius. Let's make another Sudoken. Like, they own all of these franchises. They also, other series here that they apparently own, at least according to Wikipedia, are Bomberman, Adventure Island, Frogger, although I'm not sure how... what they're going to do with that one at this time. A gritty reboot of Frogger. and then
Red Pilot.
Yeah, and there's some other stuff that's a little tougher to imagine. Sudoken was a really cool PlayStation RPG series, PlayStation 1 and PlayStation 2, that's kind of been dormant for quite a few years now.
I know you're saying Sudoken, but...
Is it Sukaden?
I think it's called Suikoden.
I don't know. The thing is, the series never really made it to games with speech in them.
Well,
so
here's the thing about that series, though. There have been multiple sequels, but only the first two are really, you know, good.
I kind of like the fifth one's not bad. It's the fourth one that's pretty bad. That kind of, I think, may have hurt the series quite a bit. The fourth Sudoken or Sukidogen or however.
I think it's Sukiden, right?
Sukiden?
Maybe, yeah.
I don't know. The fourth Sudoku, like, you have to use a boat. And games where you have to take boats from one place to another are never fun. So,
except for Wind Waker.
I thought that one... was also not that great.
How dare you?
but this game, its big claim to fame is the fact that you recruit basically stars of Destiny.
108 stars of Destiny.
Yep, and normally most of them are playable. And you know, only 20 or 30 of them are like merchants and that kind of thing. So you have like 60 to 80 different...
You build up your castle full of your stars of Destiny.
Yeah, and that...
Well, that was a huge draw for me when I was playing it, because usually in an RPG, you just get your... sword dude, you get your wizard girl, and you get your beefy beast guy, and then there you go. That's your party. But in this one, you have such a wide array of characters to collect and select from. And they also, if you have put in the correct combination, they do... combo maneuvers together.
Oh yeah, the combo attacks were lots of fun. I like the one where you could put four squirrels in your party and they would do a group attack on the enemy. It was fun. I don't know. The last game in that series was in 2012, and it was only released in Japan, and it was not well received. But it was also a kind of weird side game, which they kind of do for a lot of these series now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a solid series. First two are great in my humble opinion. The thing that really hurts it is the name. People are, I think in the U.S. they're kind of afraid to go near it just because of the name.
Yeah, they should have just called
Sudoku.
It Sudoku. Yeah, they should have just called it the Stars of Destiny or
something like that.
Destiny Stars. But
try to make it a little more mainstream appeal for the West, kind of.
Yeah, or
at least as far as like the initial like box art name goes, makes it stick out a little more.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Persona is another kind of niche series, and they've kind of gotten away with some of their side games having weird names like Shin Megumi something. But you know, it's. Why not just change the names for some of these? But anyways, so Konami has a bunch of these series that just they aren't really doing much with now. Silent Hill, I think the latest big budget game in that series has been canceled.
Well, yeah. That was also a Kojima joint, right?
Or yeah, he was supposed to be associated with
Guillermo del Toro.
Yep. And then unfortunately that got pulled. I guess if you still got it downloaded, you could still play the teaser they released for it. And but I guess they yanked that for even being downloaded now. So if you missed downloading it, you can't even see what it was. I was going to mention real quick too. On the kind of going hand in hand about talking about trying to make the game appeal a little more towards Western audiences. I jotted down on a note I wanted to bring up a little bit ago on the Twin Snakes version of Metal Gear Solid. I noticed they did that a little bit because I watched some footage of the PS1 version of Metal Gear Solid, and I noticed and I kind of looked into it a little bit too later on that they revoiced all the characters. They retained a few of the voice actors like David Hayter for Snake and all, but they even had him re-record his lines, and they really dialed back the accents for Natasha and Mei Ling and Naomi. Like they sound way more Americanized than from what I saw in the PS1 version of the game.
Oh, that's kind of interesting. The fact that they would kind of go less ethnic as we're kind of
I mean, they still got it's. You can still tell they got a little bit of an accent, but it's not as heavy as it was in the PS1 version. And I noticed too on a little bit of the gameplay footage that like when they flash warning screens and stuff like that, you'd see a little bit of Japanese text or the kanji.
Yeah.
That's not in the GameCube version at all either.
Huh.
I don't know if it's a big deal or if it could be just because the port was handled by a non-Japanese company. But I don't know, just little things I thought I wanted to make sure to point out there.
Yeah, I mean, this game does have like little bits of Japanese here and there in it, which I feel kind of gives it like a neat little flavor.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of side games and spin-off games, the Metal Gear series also has a ton of them, where to the point where I have no idea how many times they've re-released Metal Gear Solid. It's a bunch though.
Yeah,
I'm just looking right now. There's things called Metal Gear Solid Portable Ops, Metal Gear Solid Mobile. There's games like Metal Gear Arcade, Metal Gear Online.
yeah, they got a ton of them.
Metal Gear Acid, Metal Gear Acid 2, Metal Gear Solid 3, Substance, Metal Gear Solid 3, Metal Gear Solid 3, Snake Eater, Metal Gear Solid The Twin Snakes.
Yeah. I know they got it a while. It was like for almost tradition for, like, I know Metal Gear Solid 2 and 3, like, a year later they would release kind of, like, an enhanced director's cut edition, like, what was it, 2, you said was called Substance, right? And 3 was called Subsistence, maybe, I think, for their greatest hits version or whatever, or added some VR missions or some control tools.
Yes, you are correct on both of those counts. There is Metal Gear Solid 2, the base game is called Sons of Liberty, which is followed by kind of the director's cut, which is called Substance. There's Metal Gear Solid 3 Snake Eater, and then there's Metal Gear Solid 3 Substance.
Yeah. Oh, man, yeah. Yeah, they got all kinds of crazy titles for the games. And
yep. And then Metal Gear Acid is its it looks like it's the PlayStation Portable version of the series.
Mm-hmm.
There's also other games for the handhelds that I think are meant as side missions or don't really link up so much with the main games. Metal Gear Ghost Babel, whatever that might be.
Oh, that's a Game Boy Color version.
Okay.
And supposedly, if I remember right, it's supposed to be like a pretty core entry to the game. I think in America it's just called Metal Gear Solid, because I want to say I think it came out around the same time as like the PS1 game. And I mean, obviously it's just Game Boy quality graphics, but I think it's a pretty full content-wise game, but just maybe like a like a side take on it. But I know the one portable entry that did get is considered a real core entry is Peace Walker on PSP, because that was the main Kojima-led development team working on that game.
Yes, you are Correct. Whereas most of these side games, he basically gets a producer credit. Daddy gets to wet his beak on the sales, but it doesn't sound like he was involved in the nuts and bolts for a lot of these side projects like Metal Gear Solid 2 Bande Dessinée.
Oh man, I'm really looking forward to the day whenever I get around. I was kind of talking before the show started here that eventually I just want to march through the core five Metal Gear Solid games. I only played 1 and 4 all the way here, and a little bit of 2. And but I want to play the main Solid games and Peace Walker, and finish it off with that crazy Revengeance, the Platinum Games developed one where he plays a crazy cyborg Raiden.
Oh yeah, because Raiden kind of splits off to his own games because he sucks.
Yeah. Oh man, in 4 they get all crazy with his character.
Mm-hmm. Well, 4 is the one where it turns out he's 2 didn't end so well for him. He's now like a ninja cyborg.
Yep.
Like, oh, we've talked about Metal Gear Solid, but we didn't talk about the coolest boss, which is Psycho Mantis.
Yes.
Well, I also believe he is a ninja cyborg, correct?
Yeah, sounds about right.
Well, he has psychic powers.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, which...
And he's a ninja?
Yeah, I think he is, isn't he?
Well, I mean...
I believe so, yeah.
Okay.
He definitely loves to mess with you during the big boss fight there. And even leading up his little pre-boss fight ramble there, he... Mm-hmm. A lot of the fourth wall breaking involved with Psycho Mantis, which is just, you know, even if you don't plan on playing the game, definitely look it up on YouTube to see it, because it's definitely, the time when this game came out, they just weren't doing this kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think what you're alluding to is the fact that to beat Psycho Mantis, you have to use the second controller.
Yeah.
You have to move your controller to the player 2 slot. Because otherwise he just blocks all of your attacks, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I had to look it up online once I got it. I'm like, what the hell's going on? You got moved on GameCube, you got moved to port 4. And
So why is this? Is it ever explained?
Oh, because he's psychic. He is...
Is there some fourth wall breaking stuff where he says like, oh, now your controller is broken, ha ha ha, what are you going to do, big shot?
You know, He gives you a hint saying, he's like, I can predict what you're going to do next. And so you can't attack him because he'll automatically, like, block or counterattack all your attacks. And in order to get by it, it turns out, yeah, well, he didn't see you changing the controller port or whatever. So
yeah. They don't really explain how that works, how he wouldn't just know that you switched the controller port. But it's kind of clever.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that... if you have other Konami games on your PlayStation memory card, he will comment about the save files you have for them. Like Psychonauts, I think is one of them, and maybe a Sudoku. He might comment about that one as well.
Yeah, it does the same thing on GameCube though with Nintendo exclusives. There's he references Eternal Darkness and Wind Waker and Smash Brothers, so. Yeah, does the same thing there, and I just love to. I think one of the moments where I was just like, they really go over the top with the fourth wall is I just loved it was when he Psycho Mantis is like, hey, and don't cheat either. You can't use no auto fire on me. That's not right. And then Snake looks at the camera and gives you a knowing nod, as in, come on now, play fair. I was like, really.
Mantis reads the player's memory card. If the player has corresponding Konami-based save files, Psycho Mantis will comment on them. For example, you like Castlevania, don't you? Mantis also does this in the Twin Snakes, although with Nintendo game saves instead, such as Super Smash Bros. Melee, Eternal Darkness, Sanity's Requiem. If you don't have anything on the memory card or anything he recognizes, he'll say that your memory is completely clean.
during the boss fight with him, did you have the screen go black?
I did not, but I'm reading about it now. Using his blackout technique, Psycho Mantis will change the player's screen to a black screen reading Hideo in the top corner, as to replicate most standard television sets' video setting.
Yep. Yeah, that was when that happened, I was just like, oh, man. Mm-hmm. That was... Again, now you might see some... It may not have that kind of wow factor now compared... You know, you got all kinds of out there indie games experimenting with all these kind of different things to make them stand out, but... Oh, part of me really wishes I would have experienced this game when it came out just to see all this stuff that no one else was doing at the time.
Mm-hmm. There's also some of the other... kind of Easter eggs. We mentioned the codec a little bit. The player must find Meryl's frequency using a screenshot on the back of the game's packaging. It's also now in the there's a digital version of this game. It's in the manual for the digital version.
Yeah. So what I read is that they tried to use that as some form of DRM, so that you would have to have an actual copy of the game and the manual to get that.
Pretty sneaky, sis.
Yeah. That wouldn't fly in this day and age. Actually, I remember back on a lot of old PC games from the 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm. There'd be did it too.
Yeah. When you're installing them, before it would even let you install it, it'd say, like, what is the third word on the 10th page of the instruction manual?
Oh yeah, Carmen San Diego did that, and I think Metal Gear Solid, Might and Magic 3.
Yeah, just as a primitive form of DRM.
Oh, those bastards at EA were getting to us even back then. Brisket, did you have anything else you wanted to add about Metal Gear Solid here?
Yeah. I found this little snippet that says, according to Kojima, the solid in the title has three meanings. A reference of Solid Snake, mm-hmm. the game's use of 3D graphics,
mm-hmm.
and Konami's rivalry with Squaresoft.
Oh, I wasn't aware they had a rivalry.
Yeah,
I guess they did, yeah.
I mean, at that time, Square was mostly just solely an RPG company for a while.
That's true. By this point, they started branching out in the PlayStation era, but up to this point, they were definitely just RPG.
Yeah, like they did a few weird games, like I think they did Rad Racer for the NES.
Mm-hmm.
But they kind of, they found a groove with Final Fantasy, and I wasn't aware that they kind of went back to other games until they started acquiring other companies. Like, don't they do Tomb Raider now?
Yeah, because they own Eidos. They're Square Enix, which bought Eidos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not a huge Square fan anymore because they also... I don't know. A lot of these Japanese game companies seem very conservative because Square bought Enix, and now all they do is, like, re-release games from that they've already re-released three times already. Like I don't need yet another copy of Chrono Trigger. Yet another. I don't know. They're doing Final Fantasy VII again, which is kind of cool, but everyone's played Final Fantasy VII.
Like, well, I think you're kind of underselling what they're doing. I saw a little news blurb today that said Final Fantasy XV is almost complete and ready to be shipped. Something like that.
No, that's good, because Final Fantasy 13 was pretty depressing, even though they had a really cool character. So
I've not put as much time as I wanted to into many of the Final Fantasy games over the years, just a couple, and I never finished one either. I did put at least a decent amount of time to 6 and 7, but I've never finished either of those.
I'd say 4, 6, and 7 are kind of the highlights of the series to me.
Yeah. Yeah. They're the highlights, but 8 and 9 are also pretty darn good.
Yeah, definitely. And I feel like 8's a little tough to play if you're not super used to... I don't know. It's not even that you have to be used to RPGs. 8 has like a completely weird system of like fighting and equipment and that kind of stuff. But nine is just a solid RPG.
Yep. Six is the best game for Super Nintendo, by the way.
Ooh.
Hot take.
Yeah, I'd say.
Yeah, I really liked Six a lot. I played of it, and it's weird. Like, I restarted it a couple years ago, and then I put a bit more time into it earlier this year. But I guess I'm still not really all that far in the grand scheme of things. But one of these days, I'll get around to, or years, I'll get around to beating it.
Yeah, you can play that like Game Boy Advance version, which is kind of weird. But
that's what I'm playing it on. Yeah.
Oh, it has Game Boy Advance version has like some weird bugs in it.
Oh no.
Yeah, that let you double attack at times and that kind of thing.
Wait, that sounds like a good thing.
Well, yeah, it doesn't sound like a game breaking bug.
No, it's not game breaking. I just noticed it because I've played the original. But no, it's still definitely playable, and it adds a bonus dungeon. So that's only the second re-release of Final Fantasy VI. Since they also re-released it for the PlayStation.
Yeah.
With Chrono Trigger in these weird buggy super load time games.
did you see they put out an official, I think, Steam version earlier this year, which I believe, if I remember reading up on it correctly, was a port up from an old cell phone version, which has all these very botched or just not true to the spirit of the original games of their graphics, and they kind of there's a bunch of comparison side-by-side shots, and it's just a depressing update.
Oh my
if
God.
You want to call it that, to Final Fantasy VI.
And I don't know. It's so confusing to me because, like hackers, like ripping apart the Super Nintendo game, have managed to, like, you can download versions of Final Fantasy VI for the Super Nintendo that clean out the bugs. And it's like Square actually pays people money to do this. You would think that they would, you know, release a product that did not have the bugs in it, but whatever. They're weird.
Yes.
So Metal Gear Solid, Brisket, did you have any other notes on it?
Well, this game did kind of popularize the stealth genre, and this stealth, sneaky, you know, crawl up behind people genre of games. And the thing about those games is you're either in it, you're either down with it, or you're not. And I'm not that down with these kind of games. Unfortunately, because what I like to do is a game like, Elder Scrolls, where you're crouching down, you sneak up a little bit, you notch an arrow, hit him in the back of the head, and then you just run full, you know, stripped down nude with your axe hanging low and run straight at him,
I'm
yelling all the way.
That's how I play Elder Scrolls a lot, too. Yeah. Hack and slash and just give me like a heal spell. I'm good.
Right, and I don't like the games where you're sneaking around, and if you're caught, it's kind of game over, and you have to restart the mission.
Oh, those games are the worst. Where,
yeah,
like this one's a little better, where you can kind of maneuver your way back into cover, but it's still annoying. Like, you have to kind of reset yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well,
go ahead.
It's also, at least in this game, even if you do get caught, You can normally switch to like a decent weapon and actually kill people. It's not like I'm blanking on some of the other games I've played where if you're discovered in stealth mode, like they just kill you. Oh, the Batman games.
Oh yeah.
Further in the game where the bad guys have guns, it's just insta death.
Yeah, I've only actually played Arkham Asylum. Because I'm way behind on that series, but I just remember being so frustrated. I think I was playing on like easy or normal, and like if they discover you, you basically get like one or two chances to escape. Otherwise, you just get gunned down immediately, by goons with assault weapons. And meanwhile, your puny weapons like the Batarang will stun them for like 2/10 of a second, and it's almost impossible to, you know, get to all of the guys you need to in that time frame.
Yeah, I was very gracious that the game has a very easy difficulty setting, and you know, like I said, I tried not to totally abuse it, but I did usually walk around with like the suppressor on the pistol, and if I did run across bad guys, I tried to sneak up and just quickly you know, just take care of them, and but like if things did get a little crazy and I did cause an alert, then you know, like I said, you got like some better auto fire weapons at your disposal, and that can help get you out of those jams pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's definitely a game I have not Arkham Asylum. I definitely have not platinumed that game, just because all the various training stages.
Yeah, those are painful.
Yeah, Metal Gear Solid also has some VR training sessions, which I never did. So. But I think I have a little bit more affinity for the stealth games than you guys, it sounds like. Like, it's not my most favorite genre, but if a game does stealth pretty well, I like playing it. Like,
yeah. Well, there's you know, some games do it well. I guess this game supposedly does it well. But like a game like Far Cry, where you can sneak around and knife people, but if it goes down, you know, If they spot you, the sirens go off. Mm-hmm. You just switch over to your rocket launcher.
Nice. I'm slowly warming up to them in recent years, but I know for a long time I just avoided them altogether because, you know, I was just like, ah, sneaky, screw that. But they're finding ways to make them a little bit more friendly towards me anyways, at least through the beginner difficulty levels and... Or just kind of make them more like a stealth action kind of combo with more emphasis on stealth, but at least a decent amount of action in there. Like I played the Splinter Cell Conviction on 360, and I really liked that one. It was the first Splinter Cell game I played. And I remember those games were always renowned for being pretty stealthy, but that one kind of amped up a little bit more action. And I thought that one kind of really, but I did try and I tried to play stealth primarily.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Brisket, do you have any other notes there?
No, I'm good.
Okay. Dale, have any final thoughts here on Metal Gear Solid?
I will say I was pretty bummed out once I found out what Otacon stood for. I was I really liked the character in 4, and I thought that was his name the whole time, I guess. But then I'm like, oh, no, I just for people who haven't played it, I won't play it yet. I'll actually will save that little tidbit for you to get bummed out about once he tells you why his name is Otacon. I was like, oh wow, I had no idea, and that's kind of, I don't know how to really, I don't know, man. But
is that revealed in the fourth game?
No, because I played through the whole fourth game, and for whatever reason I thought I guess I should have figured that was just a code name or whatever, but he's like, no, you could call me Otacon because of this and that. And I'm like, oh, no. it's just a little nod to one of his favorite hobbies, I guess. And I don't know. It kind of took, as much as the fourth wall stuff took me out, takes you out of the game. I guess that was the one thing that I guess that caught me really off guard.
Yeah, like there's some dark stuff in his past, man.
Yes.
There's some stuff you don't want to get into normally with just a PlayStation game. Like I just came to de-stress.
And I guess I'll just add to, I really liked playing on the GameCube. I don't know if the PS1 or GameCube is definitively better. I guess I've heard over loose chatter over the years. I want to say I hear people still recommend the PS1 version over the GameCube remake, but I thought the GameCube one controlled fine gameplay wise, and the graphics are definitely easier on the eye from what I've seen of the PS1 version I was watching a little earlier today here. So
the PS1 version suffers from PS1 syndrome where it's very blurry. This happens a lot in the PlayStation games. It's just a blurry game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the PS1 N64 era graphics, those ones have definitely not, for the most part, not all of them, but a good chunk of them, yeah, definitely did not age terribly well. But for this one, it's got like almost on quality with the graphics in Metal Gear Solid 2. So it's a really good update.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's also, for economic reasons, there's no real reason to get the PlayStation version versus the other ones. Although apparently, if you do the new, if you have a new copy of Metal Gear Solid for the PlayStation for whatever reason, it goes for $113.
Oh wow!
Which seems like kind of a lot of money to me. But then again, I sold like a copy of Final Fantasy VII like for $35 a year or two ago, which I also thought was weird. Since it's been re-released a couple times, but
yeah, it's one of the best-selling PS1 games. That one always bought 7 and 8 are like two of the top 5 selling PS1 games in America. I was always surprised why those ones go for a lot.
Yeah, I think it's just because demand is high for a lot of these. For some of these older games that are unquestionably good, like they don't they don't bottom out in terms of price as much as you'd expect. There's also Metal Gear Solid for the Game Boy Color. If you ever find that, hold on to it. $42.
Oh man!
Along with $270 if it's new. So that's currently the leader in the clubhouse when it comes to Metal Gear Solid games.
Yeah, I had to pay $40. I got the Twin Snakes here about a year ago, and it was $40. A little more than I wanted to pay for it, but I was on a really big round out my GameCube collection kick back then.
Oh no, that's actually a pretty fair price for it. It's appreciated in value there, Dale. It's up to $46.
Woohoo! I saved.
You have made $6.31 according to this.
You know, it seems weird too. We kind of got a local mom pa used game shop here it seems like this last year alone, like PS2, original Xbox, and GameCube games, some random, just random selection of games have really jumped up in price this last year especially. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm. I think more people are getting savvy to the fact that the fact that some of these older games are worth money. Like I used to just go to the Walmart like bargain bin and scoop up some games here and there and then just put them immediately on online and sell them for a lot of money.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, my best scoop ever was where is it? It was one of the Monster Rancher games, they're called.
Monster Rancher, yeah.
Yeah,
that's what they're called.
Monster Rancher 4 I got for $10 at Walmart and I sold it. I think it ended up going for $55 online.
Very nice.
Yeah, so that's my super saver tip for you kids out there. Go buy games from, rip them off from old ladies and then put them online from flea markets.
I guess I got one last thing here for Metal Gear. I've been I don't know if you guys follow many Let's Plays or not, but
not so much. Is there a good one for this game or?
Yeah, well, like I don't know. I go to GiantBomb.com a lot. I'm a big fan of their videos, and every now and again they'll do some Let's Plays. And I guess this last year, amping up for Metal Gear Solid 5, two of their staff members did Let's Plays on like the 4 main Metal Gear Solid games. And since they just finished Metal Gear Solid today, that's how I watched the PS1 footage. Was I watched the first installment of their Let's Play of the original Metal Gear Solid, and like the two, one guy is just the co-host. He's like the Metal Gear pro, and he's kind of nudging the other guy in the right direction, but not really giving the game away to him, who's never played a Metal Gear Solid game before. And this other guy's just trying to play super stealthy at like a normal difficulty level, and he's just getting way into it and just very on his toes whenever he's alerting guards, and it's just. The first part alone was just a riot to watch. So, I don't know. If you're into those, I'd recommend checking out GiantBomb.com for their Let's Plays on Metal Gear Solid.
Oh, nice. I will say, the only Let's Play I've watched through its completion was for Shadowgate for the NES, which was a text and graphical adventure kind of famous for the fact that you can die in pretty much a million different ways. And it was just like a guy and his girlfriend were playing it without any real knowledge of the of the game. Well, he had knowledge and she did not, and she was the one who was mostly playing, and she basically just shrieked every 5 minutes whenever she died. So, I found that comical for probably because I'm a horrible person.
I think I've seen that one actually. I'm pretty sure I have. Yeah, that was you're right. It exactly went down like that. That one was awesome.
Yeah, it was pretty popular. I think it's one of the first. If you YouTube Shadowgate, it is one of the first results, I believe. Their Let's Play together.
Yeah, I think it's called Let's Make Maduma or something like that play Shadowgate on NES.
Perfect. All right, now I think we're ready to move on to the email portion of the show. Brisket, did you receive any mails this week?
Yes, I did indeed. Since Huel is out sneaking around the Arctic, he forwarded me one that he got.
Oh.
It's from a fan of the show, nay, friend of the show, ScooterButt42.
Oh, old Scooty.
Old Scooty. He says, "Dear your parents' accusers, the disrespect has gotten out of hand. Why would someone possibly accuse these emails where I pour out my own soul of being fake? Just who does Josh Stevens from Atlanta, Georgia think he is? Does he think that name doesn't sound made up? And he just happens to be from one of the largest cities in the country? Come on. And Sean H. from Warwick, Rhode Island? Not even man enough to give his last name. This insanity needs to stop. I assure you, I am a real person who simply loves a podcast about video games. My family has even written in. By the way, who's your favorite Mario Kart racer? Faithfully yours, ScooterButt42.
Oh. My favorite Mario Kart racer is probably... I'm going to go with Toad. He's always fun to race with.
Yeah. He's a quick go-to. He's the one that if it's your first time playing, you'll probably go with Toad or maybe a Koopa Troopa.
Yeah, you
cute
don't
little cute little racers.
Yeah, Koopa Troopas are definitely always fun. I've always been a go-to Wario guy though.
Yeah. Well, he's fun to win with because of all the noises he makes when he's driving.
Heck yeah.
Yeah,
I'll tell you the person I hate racing against the most, especially in Double Dash, and it's freaking Donkey Kong because he keeps
Donkey
pooping
Kong,
out
those
bananas, those gigantic bananas everywhere. I got friends that love to abuse. They love to troll around with Donkey Kong. Ooh.
He's so annoying when he passes you and he makes that whatever that sound is that he makes, that monkey sound. My go-to racer is either Mario or Luigi. I just hit the middle of the road. They are... you know, they're not as fast as Bowser or Donkey Kong. They're not as quick. They don't have as much torque as Koopa Troopa or Toad. They don't have as much speed off of the gate. But Mario and Luigi, I like them because they're, you know, all around good racers. They have nice maneuverability. Mm-hmm. You can slide around easier. And yeah.
Oh. That's kind of a cliche answer, but
cliche would be if I said Yoshi.
Oh well, yeah, Yoshi is for children. Yoshi is for little kids, little Bimmies and Jimmies.
Little Bimmy.
All right. Well, I got one email this week. It is not from Sean H. Unfortunately. It is from Orenthal, and he writes, "Hey guys, I can't believe someone asked if the emails you get are fake. Who's your favorite racer in Super Mario Kart?" Mine, of course, is Koopa Trooper.
Yeah, mine. I'm gonna have to go with You know what? I'm going to go with Luigi on this one. It's a tough choice. But he's a good solid racer.
Okay.
You know, I used to be the same way, thinking, you know, Mario and Luigi, but then in the last several years of upgrade to Wario, I need that power.
Yeah. he does have a higher top speed than most of the other racers.
Mario Stadium on N64, favorite track.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah.
Oh, that is fun. It has like the shortcut in the middle.
Yep. Especially, they got that early shortcut right at the beginning of the race. If you can nail that, jumps you to the halfway point.
And then if you time your red shells when somebody's going over that jump and hit them as they go over the top, it knocks them down to the bottom, so they have to go back around again.
Or better yet, you can hang on to the lightning to right before they get down. And then you'll get people chucking controllers at you in good times.
Now, Brisket, did you have your own email this
week? Yeah, I did get an email directly to me, and it's from Frank N. from Toronto, Canada. It says, "Dear Todd, who is or has not been the most favoritist Mario Kart racer guy, or has never even?"
Oh, well, did you want to answer first, Todd, or John?
Well, you know. Peach is a good one to go with sometimes. You know, she's a little bit more nimble than Mario and Luigi, but she's good, a good solid average racer.
Oh yeah.
She'll hit the middle of the road.
Oh. My favorite racer is Yoshi, because he's for dignified adults to use. What about you, Dale?
Oh gosh. I'm gonna have to go with Piranha Pete from Double Dash.
Piranha Pete. Now they're just making people up. Who the hell is Piranha Pete?
He's in the game past the Nintendo 64 version, so Steve doesn't know who it is.
Oh, shoot. Yeah, my bad. Oh, man. Or how about Donkey Kong Jr. from the SNES? There we go. Go to.
Well, Donkey Kong Jr. was basically dead for years, and then he resurfaced in the kart games, right?
Yeah, and that one, and he was only in the original. That's the only one they used him on. Then they upgraded to his daddy for the rest of them. And he was also in the Virtual Boy, Mario Tennis. and then we haven't seen him since.
Yeah.
Yeah, him and I don't know, Nintendo, as we mentioned on the Kid Icarus show, they'll just sour on certain people. They also,
yeah, I think,
Koopa Kids.
That's true. Yeah, they haven't been around since when? Like Mario 3 for sure, but I can't remember since then.
They've been.
Make appearances in those Mario Paper Mario games, right?
They're in the new Mario Brothers games.
Yeah, but the new Mario, like the new Super Mario Brothers games, are basically just like Nintendo just redoing Mario games, kind of. Redoing Mario games, but it's like, oh, people love the traditional side-scroller stuff. Let's do the opposite of what Square would do. And Square would just re-release Super Mario Brothers like 57 times. Mm-hmm. Instead, Nintendo's like, well, why don't we see what we can do and make some new stages here? And now they've fully embraced it in a weird way with the Super Mario Creator.
Mario Maker, that is pretty cool. I've been playing a decent amount of that in the last few months.
It doesn't seem like something I'd be in love with, but every once in a while, on the Twitter, I'll see like a neat stage shared, and I'm like, oh, that is kind of cool. Like there's like people have made beginner stages, like tutorial stages for Mario, where there are like arrows pointing out everything you can do in the game and that kind of stuff, and they've recreated like all of the old Mario games in Mario Maker, so it does seem like it's kind of cool.
Yeah, like I'm not really much for the creation stuff. I just love downloading people's levels or like even developers' levels. They've got some really good like Kotaku had a good curated list of like top pick levels, and you just mess around with those or just do like. They got a Mario Maker or the Mario Challenge mode where it just does like a random 8 or 10 levels. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for better or worse, some of the levels are really cool, real fun. And if you don't like one, they make it real easy to skip and do another one. And it's just had a couple buddies over one day. We're just passing controller around and yeah, it was a good time. So, yeah.
Yeah.
That's definitely, I think, a must-buy if you get a Wii U.
Yeah, and doesn't it show you, like, the percentage of people who have actually completed a stage and that kind of stuff?
Yep. So if you're doing crappy on a stage and you only see, like, it has, like, a 2% completion rate, you don't feel as bad anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there any mechanism in place for, like, because I'm sure there are some stages that are probably just actually impossible to do. Is there?
Yes.
Oh, so there's like no mechanism outside of the 0% that it shows to know that, hey, this is unbeatable?
Well, I mean, I guess, no, I'd be lying to say if it would be impossible, because part of Nintendo's rules for uploading your created levels is you have to at least beat it once before uploading it. And so that it's proven that it is beatable. But
that's ingenious. Yeah. Oh, good for them.
Yeah, but for some of the crazy stuff you got to do, it seems like some people must have got lucky with the way they got their completions going, or they got some cool like mini Let's Plays online of people doing some like mini Mario, like Patrick Klepek. I would recommend look up on YouTube. He has a little thing called Mario Mornings, I think, where he does just almost a few days a week, just little half-hour random play sessions of the latest from the Mario Maker community. It's really entertaining to watch.
Oh, cool. Well, I don't expect that I'll get a positive answer here, but Dale, did you get any emails? Did anyone know you were coming on to the show?
Yes, sirree, Bob. I got two fax trollers hot off the wires today.
Oh.
Wow.
Oh.
Yep.
That's that's so odd, since we didn't even advertise that you were going to be on.
I got my fax.
There's so much notoriety from last time he was on.
Yeah, true. It must be.
I sent out a wire today saying, "Hey, I'm going to be on YPB.
Oh.
Send me your hot faxes. Faxes are still a thing." So
I'm surprised you got faxes and not telegrams.
Maybe next time
we'll see.
Never say never. Yeah. This first one comes from username Bring Back Slam Ball.
Wait, Slam Ball as in the trampoline game?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man, I could go for some Slam Ball. Cannot
disagree with that username.
Heck yeah. Anyways, yeah. Mr. Slam Ball here says, "Hey guys, thanks for doing an episode about StarCraft. But you never touched on the N64 version. Have any of you played it, or have memories of any other late PC to console ports?"
Oh, I mean, I did look up a little bit of info on that, and I don't think we got to it on the show. That version of the game is worth some money now, and I think it adds like a bonus stage or two, but most of the reviews just focused on how clunky it was to play.
Yeah. I couldn't imagine playing a real-time strategy game with a control pad.
Yeah.
I don't even know how that works. Like, you have a little mouse you use your stick to control?
I have played a ton of the N64 version of StarCraft 64. I haven't.
Wow.
I loved StarCraft on PC. I played a ton of it. I used to have buddies. We'd meet up a couple times a month, play it for at least the first like 5 years that game was out. I even have a crappy, stupid StarCraft fan page on my old Tripod website. But yeah, so when the N64 version came out, when I used to go over to other friends who didn't have internet at the time, we would bust out the N64 version of StarCraft and play its awful two-player split-screen mode, which had bad slowdown, real bad slowdown, because N64 could barely handle the single player. They somehow got all the missions in there, but like they had to take out a lot of the audio because the cartridge couldn't hold it all. And it was very watered down, but somehow they got a two-player split-screen version to work in there. But
now, it seems playing a two-player game kind of takes away some of the mystery, because you can see what the other person is building.
Yeah. Well, it was fun. You could do two-player versus computer, so you could actually team up against a computer. But you can only really do up to one, because even with that many units on the screen, you'd get a lot of slowdown just for two versus one computer, though the option is in there to do two versus four, I don't want to even attempt it though, because yeah.
No,
yeah,
did you get the memory pack expansion for your Nintendo 64? Maybe that would help.
That was the only way you could do a 2-player was with the expansion. Yeah.
I had the same thought as you did about the split screen, but then again, that never really affected the fun of GoldenEye. I imagine in a way it might make it even, it would make games longer and more competitive if you knew what the other person was doing.
I will.
Sure. Okay.
I'll admit to doing some occasional glancing over to the, you know, see where everyone was at in GoldenEye or even StarCraft. That was a very dirty tactic in StarCraft, though, because I remember playing against my brother one time, and we did do a truce to not look at each other's screen, but
yeah.
I saw he was amassing a big old battlecruiser rush outside my base, and so I decided to nuke him and blow him up, to which he turned off the system. But yeah.
Oh, you dirty cheater. You dirty boy.
But by the time I was a big StarCraft fanboy, so I tolerated the hindrances of the 64 version.
As far as other kind of, was it PC or real time strategy to console?
I guess any doesn't matter, I guess
The only game that I arguably think is better console than, like, a PC original that came to the console. Actually, it wasn't even a PC original, but Doom 64. I had that game, and I quite liked it.
How is it better than the PC version?
It's better because I think it's, like, the last kind of Doom game before Doom 3. Came out, so it was kind of it had the most refined stages and not a bunch of new weapons, but the weapons they had were kind of updated graphically, that kind of thing. They had some new enemies in there, and I think it had 30 stages, I want to say, and they were new stages. They were not retreads from like Final Doom and Doom 2. So
yeah, I always wanted to play that one. I never did.
No, it's a fun little game. It still doesn't add jumping, which by this time, like, I think Quake had been out for like 3 or 4 years at this point. So I think that's part of the reason Doom 64 was kind of already a relic in a way. But if you want that Doom experience, it's not bad. And also in a way, because the N64 had the analog stick, it was actually kind of easier to circle strafe enemies with the 64 controller than the keyboard on the PC. So.
Oh yeah, yeah, that would make sense. I remember using that not for Doom, but for like GoldenEye and Perfect Dark. That kind of made it a little nice.
Yeah, yeah, you could circle strafe pretty easily.
I guess I do remember playing like the Quake games on N64, and then the later versions of Quake and Unreal Quake on N64, then also like Quake 3 on PS2 and Unreal Tournament on PS2 and Dreamcast. And those were all right, but I always got the feeling that they were better on the PC.
Yeah, but not all of us were a part of the PC master race who could afford.
I've made my opinion known that on shooters, I cannot handle a controller. I'm only a mouse and keyboard guy.
Yeah,
if you give me a controller, you give me a controller, I'll just be sitting there staring at the ground or staring at the ceiling.
Yep. For the longest time, I only played like just real-time strategy games and like SimCity and SimCopter on PC. I never really gravitated for anything else on there for the longest time. Mm. First game facts review of mine is SimCopter. If you order a piece of crap, there you go.
Oh, we might have to for the bestest game ever segment at some point. Mm-hmm.
There you go. Future segment.
A couple of mine were pretty bad as well. Well, what was your second mail there?
Second facts. Here we go. This comes from user USFL Forever.
Oh, boy.
I think these guys are cousins. Oh, yo, YPB, Just curious, since we are late in the NFL season, what are your memories of 16-bit Madden or other gridiron favorites of that era for you? It seemed Madden back then compared to now was a perfect blend of easy to pick up and play action, yet still had a very sim feel to it to appeal to the best of both arcade and sim fans now than what you get with today's Madden. Later.
You know what? I have a hot take. I did not like the John Madden football games for the 16-bit era. I'm sure I might feel differently now because I could probably play them because I know more about football. But at the time, like, I would just throw tons of interceptions because I could not tell when my guys were actually open or not. It was also probably a factor of I was a Tecmo Bowl guy. So to me, like, my guys weren't open unless there was, like, nobody standing near them, which frankly does not happen in the Madden games. So,
yeah, those early Maddens were rough when you had, like, the window passing, and you remember that?
Yes, I do. And it was weird because you'd see the window and it would look like, oh, there's nobody near him. I should throw it. But that means actually you shouldn't throw it because by the time you throw it, the cornerback will catch up.
Yeah, the window only had like a little like 1 yard halo around each receiver. Yeah, no idea.
Yeah, the windows do nothing, just like goggles. So
The later Maddens on the 16-bit, when they got rid of window passing, it really opened up the field down there, and it made it a lot better. I put a lot of time into like Madden 97 and 98 on the Genesis a lot with some buddies.
The first one I really got into was Madden 64, which was it was perfectly fine. It was a perfectly fine football game. So.
Oh yeah, yep. Especially now when the first ones to add franchise mode. Yeah, those ones were really good. Yeah.
Brisket, did you play any of the old Madden games there?
Well, I mentioned it on the NHL game or NHL episode we did. I mentioned it on the Tecmo Bowl episode and on the baseball game, Bases Loaded. Is that what we did?
Yep.
Forgot. I was not a sports ball game guy growing up. I played the sports balls in the real life, but I was more into, you know, dragons and elves on my video games. So I didn't put much time into Madden on the Super Nintendo.
You were first Team All Valley, and of course you wanted to escape from that harsh
That's right.
life.
I can play football in real life. Why do I need to play it on a Nintendo? You know, I can't slay a dragon in real life, so that's what I got to do on my Pretendos.
Yeah, in fact, most people don't know that the character of James Vanderbeek in Varsity Blues was based on your high school career.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think that wraps up the emails. So kind of sign off here. Brisket, do you have any last words of wisdom here?
Sure. Snake, please save yourself. Go on living and don't give up on people.
I guess that's kind of
it's kind of like the core message of the game.
Yeah, it's somewhat inspirational.
Yeah.
Kind of. Dale, thank you so much for guesting, for being a second-time guest here on the YPB podcast. Do you have any last words of wisdom here?
Oh, gosh. No, nothing. No. But all thanks right. for having me. I love this. This definitely inspired me to, instead of going like, yeah, I'll play Metal Gear Solid one of these days. I'm going to play all the games here in order. And instead of that not happening, this inspired me to actually play it and get through it. And now I feel way more motivated to march through the rest of the games here. So
I'm glad we encouraged you to play this game instead of spending time with your family.
Heck yeah, woo! It's like there was a holiday or something I should have paid attention to those last couple of weeks.
No. December and November aren't really big holiday months. So, with that in mind, here is a snifferoo of next week's game that comes from a galaxy far, far away.